ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. For nearly six decades, Wilson Sonsini has represented the technology pioneers associated with virtually every tech milestone innovation. Daniel Glaser, an American technology lawyer and strategic business advisor, is the founding partner of Wilson Sonsini's London office. Since the 2010 launch of the UK government's Tech City initiative, Dan has advised high-growth UK and other European technology and life sciences companies on raising capital, expanding their business into US markets, and connecting with investors, corporate advisors, and other stakeholders. Hi, Daniel. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Your firm, Wilson Sonsini, has represented more technology companies in venture financings, IPOs, and M&A exits than any other law firm. It's Silicon Valley's anchor tenant and has taken public some familiar names like Apple, Google, Dropbox, LinkedIn, Sun, Tesla, Twitter, just, you know, to name a few of the small ones there. So I provided the view at 60,000 feet. Can you give us a bit more background about the firm and its approach and mission?
Sure thing. So the firm was one of the first law firms in Silicon Valley in the early 1960s to focus on technology companies, right? I mean, as the Valley started to grow and scale and focus on on building and developing what eventually became world beating technology companies, sort of we as a firm focused on scaling with that ecosystem, and the model has always been, you know, to work with the proverbial single founder in a garage, as it were, you know, and so support them not only on legal matters, but really as a business and strategic advisor as well, as they scaled through venture financings, through, commercial partnerships, all the different, sort of legal issues that they would face as they get bigger. And then eventually going public on the NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange or through some sort of sale or M&A exit. It's always been the focus on, not only, scaling with them through that stack, as it were, but being a commercial and business advisor all along the way, not just legal, but a full sort of 360 degree, sounding board and guide for the company as it builds. That's what we think of as the sort of classic Silicon Valley model. During the dot-com boom, we sort of expanded that model, to other technology hubs. And then in this decade, or especially over the past 10 years or so, been focusing, my team in particular has focused on working with technology companies coming out of the UK and broader Europe as well, through their so-called US life cycle, launch, scale, raise money, and exit in the United States.
Right, but so in London though, you're not a barrister, you're an American attorney in London, right?
That's correct.
So, why did your firm decide to expand into the UK with that model? Or do you also have barristers who are serving that legal advisor in the UK, in Europe? Or is it a slightly different interaction? Are you mainly advising them on how to tap into US markets? And so they really are looking for that US expertise.
Right. It's primarily the latter. Right, and what drew us to London was frankly seeing the Silicon Valley model being replicated across the Atlantic. I mean, to give you an idea of the scale of it, in 2010, there was roughly $100 million invested into London technology companies. By 2019, that number had risen to roughly $10 billion invested into London technology companies. So that's 100 million to 10 billion in 10 years. And what we found very early on is that that disproportionately those companies would look to scale into the US, right? That once they built up to a certain size in the UK, their next market, or perhaps their most important market, very commonly would be the US, whether that is launching with a team on the ground in the US and building that up, or commercial partnerships with US customers or selling it to US users, raising venture and growth capital from US investors, potentially listing on the NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange, or being acquired by a US acquirer. But one way or the other, what we found is what eventually became has become the number two tech ecosystem in the world, not surprisingly, needs to have very strong ties with the number one tech ecosystem in the world. And so that's what we've sort of built the model on, is bringing sort of augmented reality Silicon Valley into London to allow the UK and the broader European tech ecosystem to more easily access, not just the US legal support, but the US connectivity and sort of strategic advice as well.
So is it still, in terms of who you're partnering with over there, are you still looking at single founders who you're scaling with, or are these companies that are at a slightly different point in their life cycle when they come in contact with you?
Yeah, I mean, it's still the way that we describe it is it's stage agnostic, but it's not geography agnostic, right? I mean, we very commonly meet founders who are coming out of some of the top UK or European accelerator programs, whether it be someone like a Techstars or an Entrepreneur First, and that might be literally one or two founders and nobody else in the company, and they may decide that they're going to move the business to the Bay Area to raise their angel round. We work with companies like that all the time. On the other end of the spectrum, right, we regularly speak with UK PLCs, right, publicly traded companies in the UK who are looking to potentially acquire US companies, right? And it's all within the same sector, which is tech. It is all geography consistent, which is a focus on the US coming out of the UK, but from a stage standpoint, it's stage agnostic.
Right. Has Brexit changed or shifted any of your mission or setup, or not really?
Not really. I mean, it's interesting. In fact, actually, the way that it has not impacted what we are doing. I mean, I guess I'll start by saying that it's long been my own view that London is a fantastic place to start and scale a technology company, and that nothing about Brexit has changed that in my mind. If everything continues on as it has been, irrespective of Brexit, then I think we would continue to see companies build and scale in the UK and then expand to the US. If for some reason, there start to be headwinds in the UK, and for any reason, it becomes a less favorable place to build a business, which I do not expect, to be clear. Mm-hmm. But if for any reason, headwinds were created in building a business in the UK, then I suspect that would lead companies to potentially look at the US earlier in their life cycle. But I don't see Brexit, changing the interest in the United States. I guess it to the extent that it may or may not create more or less favorable business conditions on this side of the Atlantic, it just may impact how early or late stage a company might look at the US market, whether for commercial or operational reasons or for fundraising.
Right. I was just curious, especially in terms of labor movement and whether you were seeing any shift in terms of who the sort of boots on the ground were, and if there was any difference because of Brexit and the less fluidity or the fear of less fluidity.
I think what we've actually seen, or I should say rather, what has had the biggest impact has been the COVID environment, right? It's very difficult now, or more difficult than it used to be, to send people over from, you know, a UK or other European HQ over to the US, right? The travel restrictions being what they are. It's more difficult to get work visas. It's more difficult to have the right to enter the country, and it's funny how that's played out. For I think the first couple of months, when lockdown restrictions began in the UK, so that would have been March. I would say in sort of mid to late March and April, maybe even into May. I do think that there was a bit of a slowdown in terms of companies coming out of the UK and launching for the first time in the US, which frankly makes all the sense in the world, right? I mean, that was a period of time where I think companies globally were sort of taking stock of where business was headed, where the world was headed. I think coming out of lockdown over the summer, and this has become particularly clear in July and August, is that the U.S. market remains extremely attractive, and more companies are sort of still expanding to the U.S. despite the travel restrictions. And so what we're seeing now is an increased willingness to launch and scale a business in the U.S. without actually sending anyone across from HQ. So only hiring locally and building up locally. And I will say that historically, I think more often than not, the way that we had seen American teams built up by UK companies going to the US would be a mix of local hires with individuals who truly have the DNA of the business, right? Who would come over and then scale integrated teams in the US. But given that it's uncertain when travel restrictions are going to end, and that the US remains an attractive commercial market, it's pretty interesting that you've seen companies increasingly saying, well, it might not be the optimal way to go to market, not sending anyone across, but we still want to go to market in the US because the opportunities there are so massive.
Right. Well, that's just started though, in terms of no HQ travel. And there's also a lot of people are working remotely, even if they're in the States, they're not necessarily co-located. So the work experience may be one where they're pretty integrated, or the sensation is they're as integrated as they would be if they were boots on the ground here in the US, because nobody's going into an office, at least given the state of affairs here at the moment.
That's right.
So I was curious. So you land in London, Cameron's made his announcement, the plague hits. what are the areas of innovation that you are looking at, and where do you see white space, and has it changed because of COVID?
So, I think the areas of innovation that the UK, London and the UK more broadly, are particularly renowned for, and where we're seeing companies particularly exciting coming from, and certainly fintech. It's pretty extraordinary the size and the scale of the fintech businesses that have been built out of London in particular. Sort of the ideal mix of people with experience in the financial sector being able to essentially walk down the block, as it were, and find people who are skilled in technology. Put that together with the seat of government also being in London, the regulators are in London, plenty of venture capital investors are in London, regulators who are willing to be fairly flexible in an appropriate manner to in support of the fintech sector, and it all sort of is thrown together into a pretty heady mix that has been a real cradle of fintech on this side of the Atlantic, and that has continued to boom, certainly in spaces like payments in particular, during the recent COVID period, and we don't see that slowing down anytime soon. Did digital health, perhaps not unexpectedly, has been a real growth area as well, both pre-COVID and during the COVID environment. They're obviously great universities in the UK. Plus the NHS has really spurred on, the National Health Service in the UK has really spurred on in innovation. And increasingly, we see the UK taking a leading role there, both regionally and globally in the digital health space. AI is a big one. Starting with technology coming out of the universities, which is increasingly being more and more effectively commercialized.
Well, AI though is such a broad, it's huge. So if you were to, you could say, well, there's AI, you could build AI into your healthcare or your payments or
right.
your other things. So is AI bundled or are these separate standalone AI only? Define AI a little bit more for me?
Yeah, I think what I would say is that the raw technology itself is being developed at a very rapid pace and at a very high level at the top universities in the UK, and then it's applied in a myriad of different ways in fintech, in digital health, in cybersecurity, right? In all the sort of different areas that you might want to use it in autonomous driving, right? But what I think is particularly interesting is the quality of the underlying technology that's coming out of the universities. I mean, that's where DeepMind came out of, for example, a number of years ago, that was bought by Google. Mm-hmm. I think London in particular, I would describe as a little bit like New York, right? Where let's say you take New York and London on the one hand and Silicon Valley on the other, and New York and London, you could argue it's the model of their tech ecosystems are tech supporting industry, right? Is that you've in right. both cities, you've got core industries there that have been around for, in some instances, hundreds of years. I mean, like the financial services industry, in both New York and London sort of needs no introduction.
Right.
And so you end up with tech ecosystems where I think disproportionately it's tech supporting industry. Whereas in Silicon Valley, it's sort of tech is the industry.
Right.
Right. And that leads to a different type of company being built more often than not. It's also why I think, when we look back on it over the past several years, we see increasingly that earlier stage companies, when they expand from, let's say, the UK or Europe to the US, tend to go to the Valley disproportionately, right? There's exceptions all over the place, but disproportionately, we see a lot more early stage companies. When they expand, they go to the Valley. Whereas when they're slightly later stage, you see them actually go more to New York or to Boston.
To hit the industry that they're in service of.
Exactly, right? In other words, when they're earlier stage, they're still building the business, and the Valley is a pretty incredible place, to build a tech business. Whereas when they're slightly later stage, what they're looking to do is essentially Americanize a business that has already shown proof of concept, right? That they've already built out once, and now they're looking to replicate it in the American environment, and the American environments that look most similar to a London or a Paris or an Amsterdam are the big cities like a New York, like a Boston.
Right. I'm curious what your opinion is on blockchain as it relates to fintech and payments. And are you seeing, there was a lot of buzz around, cryptocurrencies and blockchain, and then it seems to have sort of evaporated, at least in terms of the general public consciousness. Is that because it was really flash in the pan? It's not ready to go. It's not useful. It doesn't have good applications. It's not as secure as they thought.
I actually would liken it a little bit to the internet itself, right? When you sort of think back to the 90s into the early 2000s, there was the massive enthusiasm that the World Wide Web and the internet would revolutionize everything, and ended up with a little bit of a bubble, you might say, you know, and then it scaled back a bit, and then it grew more steadily, and then in fact it did take over everything.
So it became true, but it wasn't true at the time that everybody was going bananas.
And so that's my own personal opinion about blockchain. Is I personally do believe in the promise of the blockchain. I'm not sure that it was the savior that it was necessarily maybe thought to be when it first emerged as the technology of the moment a few years ago, but that doesn't mean I wouldn't count it out. I think it's probably a little bit more under the radar now from a, you know, popular perception standpoint,
right?
Because it's being perfected, and maybe I should say its applications are being honed and its applications are being perfected. And I don't think that from a popular public perception standpoint, I don't think that we've seen the last of the blockchain.
Well, it's curious. A couple of years ago, I interviewed somebody, a blockchain technology CEO, and the way he was speaking about it was really Internet 2.0, that the whole framework, everything would change. And so that's interesting. I wonder how, you know, given how entrenched everything is right now, how possible that is. But it's interesting to see where things head and where they go. So shifting a little bit, when looking at the companies that you're engaging with in London, when you meet a new venture, what are some of the things that you look for? Because obviously a lot of companies are probably looking at you saying, "Ooh, pick me." So what are those things that inspire, that tempt, that energize you? And what are some red flags where you're like, "Ooh, that's a thing I have to think about."
Yeah, I think we've learned over time that, you know, that there's a certain type of company that is more likely than not to succeed when launching and scaling in the United States. And a lot of it comes down to simply the cost of doing business in the United States, right? There was a study done by the London-based venture capital firm Octopus Ventures a couple of years ago, and they wrote an extensive report on U.S. expansion based on the experiences of their portfolio companies, and as part of that report, they laid out the budget, right, for, let's say, the first year of a company, tech company's life in London and in New York and Silicon Valley and in, I think it was Austin, Texas as well. And the cost, especially the cost of employees, in all of those cities, was just far greater than building a business in London. And, you know, we sort of set companies' expectations pretty early on in terms of what the cost of doing business is in the U.S. Like for example, you know, if someone comes to us and they're still loss making and they've, you know, raised $500,000 and say, right, I'm going to go hire, you know, five top tier salespeople in New York. And the answer is no you're not, right?
No.
Right. And you know, it's interesting that I think over time we're now at the point that, you know, when we meet companies in the UK or Europe who say I'm going to go to the US, I would say we probably end up talking about 30% or more out of going to the US on the timeline that they thought they were going to go to the US.
That's right? Fascinating. I'm also surprised that the labor costs in the US are more than the UK. I always mentally think of labor costing more due to the sort of social tax structures in Europe and the UK. So that's just not the case. Or is it just that these people, once they're in the US, are high ticket employees and they just are pricey?
That's part of it. But for, you know, for whatever reason, at least for the types of employees that technology companies would look to hire, you know, whether those are engineers, whether those are salespeople, you know, et cetera, the at least in the major tech hub cities, the salaries are all higher than in London. And on top of that, of course, you have the benefit packages as well, retirement benefits, health insurance, you know, all of that. Fully loaded employees much more expensive in the US than in the UK, which actually has led to a model where, at least for a while, in their development of their US business, a lot of UK companies will let's say set up in the US with the types of employees that are most likely to provide ROI relative to having those employees back in the UK. In other words, they'll hire American salespeople, but if you get the right ones, can, you know, pay for themselves and much more.
Right.
And or they'll hire, you know, really top tier customer support people, or they'll hire, you know, really top tier marketing and BD people. What they won't necessarily do is go and try to replicate the entire back office in the United States, because they don't need that. Right. They can leverage the UK for that. They'll just be paying higher salaries without really much in the way of ROI. But I, you know, back to sort of the initial question, I think that's the easiest way for us to sort of set expectations with companies that talk to us about how realistic the US is in their future. And we really do try to stress to companies that they want to be, generally speaking, they want to be pulled into the US by customer traction or user growth, as opposed to sort of them pushing themselves into the US, right? Like they want to feel some sort of pull that the US clearly is a place where they will have product market fit. It's a lot riskier to, let's say, go over, plant the flag, start spending money thinking, well, this should work because I'm a tech company, right? And I'm a tech company, this is America, so if I have product market fit in the UK, I should automatically have product market fit in the US. Not necessarily.
Right.
We've seen plenty of companies who were great UK companies who never did get that product market fit right in the US. And those are the ones that we, you know, the way we describe it is that they go too quickly. Right. But then the other type of company that we sometimes find is the company that doesn't go quickly enough. And that's that's the one that really does have the product market fit. And they'll get that foothold, that beachhead in the US market. But then, you know, some companies will struggle because, you know, as we've just talked about, the US is a much more expensive market in which to do business than the UK. The upside, if you get it right, is massive, right?
Right.
But you know, it's hard when it's not your home market to start, you know, for example, paying your US salespeople more than anybody else in the organization, including the CEO.
Right. It just doesn't feel right, and they have difficulty with it.
Right. And so what happens to some companies is that they don't scale quickly enough, and they get lapped by more aggressive, more free spending American companies. Right. So that's one of the bits of advice that we talk to companies who are serious about going, which is because the question we're often asked, not surprisingly, is what's the most common mistake that you see companies make when they go to the US? And in a roundabout way, I've just answered that, which is it half the time it's companies that don't go too quickly, right? That make the investment in the US without having proof of concept that it's the right place to invest. And then the other half are the ones that don't go quickly enough, that it is the right place to make the investment, but they're unwilling to invest as aggressively as they should.
Right. It's almost like as a kid playing jump rope, jumping in. You got to hit that timing and then you're fine. But it's really having faith in yourself and knowing that you're going to hit that timing. So is it your job then to really get these companies sometimes on board, like, yes, you can do it. Now's the time. Scale, spend, go, go, go. Or does it just not happen? They just say, no, we're not going to do it.
That's a broad generalization. I think.
Or do they do it halfway? In which case, they've spent the money, but they don't. They're not really in it. I mean, is that sort of another problem that they spend some but not enough?
So I think over time, what we've realized is the way that companies should think about this, and they should sort of constantly ask themselves this once they've launched in the U.S. is that, you know, how important is the U.S. to the company, right? And what I mean by that is this, is that, you know, is the company one that the success or failure of the business depends on whether it wins or loses the U.S. market, right? And that's not every business, right? There are plenty of highly successful UK tech companies that have no U.S. presence or have a, you know, token U.S. presence, because you know what, the U.S. is not there, the market that they have to win to be massively successful as a business.
Right.
But once the company does answer that question in the affirmative, once it looks at the operation and the likely, you know, the likely opportunities in front of it, and it says yes, actually, the success or failure of this enterprise depends on our ability to win the U.S. market, that's when you really need to think about putting some of your best players into the U.S., whether that means moving the founder CEO over, whether that means moving other people from the executive team, whether it means hiring somebody in the States who has essentially CEO type authority. One way or the other, you have to now recognize that you are looking to win, you know, a road game, right? You are on the road, or in the British parlance, you are playing an away match, right? So, you know, how are you going to be best positioned to win that game on the road? Are you going to win that game against the incumbents who are playing on their home field by keeping your best players, you know, back home? Probably not.
Are the refs fair? I just keep thinking of all these horrible metaphors. Sorry.
We can debate whether capitalism is a fair system or not.
Well, yeah. Last question, because we've actually run through our time, but I don't want to leave this question out. There's a notorious diversity problem in Silicon Valley and in the VC universe. And what steps are you taking as a firm to make sure that unconscious bias isn't? And how are you actively helping your clients to address this concern?
Yeah, no, this is something that we take very, very seriously and have gotten involved in a number of initiatives within the UK ecosystem. And by the way, I do think that London and the UK more broadly within the tech ecosystem is focused on this issue, and has been taking real steps to try to address it. Couple things that we're involved in. Number one is Included VC, which is an initiative by I think roughly 10 VC funds in the UK and throughout Europe. To identify the next generation of investors and train them up, right? And train a new diversified generation of VCs, and then eventually place them with funds throughout Europe. Really go from the ground up, training a new diverse generation of investors, which will, you know, hopefully lead to a more diversified approach in investing itself, right? The more diversified the investors, the more diversified their backgrounds, the more diversified the deploying of capital becomes. And that's an initiative that we were one of the founding partners. We were one of the first partners on board to join that. And we're very, very supportive of that. Another initiative we were involved in, the co-working, London co-working space Tech Hub, had created a program to create specific co-working spaces and opportunities and programs for diverse companies and diverse founders that we also have participated since the inception. A couple other initiatives in London, in the UK more broadly, I'll highlight is a diversity VC, which is an initiative that's been around for a couple years. Again, looking to bring diversity, both ethnic and gender, into and other diversity as well, into the UK and broader European investor community. But there's certainly, and I know that, and I apologize because I know that I'm leaving out other initiatives, and that is not through any intent. It's through my own lack of memory, and I apologize for that.
Well, no, I mean, I think included VC sounds very concrete. You know, some stuff like that, where you're actually, it takes a little bit of time, but it creates a structural change, because that's really, you know, where that's where it has to happen, I think. And so I think that's very interesting and impressive. Anyway, we have run through our time. So I want to thank you so much for joining us in conversation. It's been really interesting. I could obviously talk to you for a lot longer, but we have run through our time. So thank you for joining us.
You got it. Thanks again for having me. Really appreciate it.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking my production team at Up Next, my friend Rob Naughton, the voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, all of you, the members of our audience. Thank you. I'll be talking to you again next time, right here on Up Next.